Have you ever felt a twinge of worry about AI taking over your job or diluting your creativity? Well, what if you could turn that fear into creative fuel? We've just published an amazing new ebook called The 4 Keys to Success in an AI World, and this is more than just a guide. It's a deep exploration into the human skills that AI can't touch, the skills that are essential for standing out and thriving no matter how much technology evolves. We're talking about real differentiators here like creativity, emotional intelligence, critical thinking, and much more. Inside, you'll find actionable insights and strategies to develop these skills, whether you're a creative person, a business person, or just simply someone who loves personal development. This isn't a story about tech taking over. It's a story of human creativity thriving alongside AI. Picture this: AI as your creative co-pilot, not just as a tool, but a collaborator that enhances your unique human skills. The 4 Keys ebook will show you exactly how to do that and view AI in a new way that empowers you instead of overshadows you. Transform your creative potential today. Head over to unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. Use the number 4, KEYS. That's unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. And download your free copy.
The Buddha tells this great story to his disciples about a guy who is, you know, comes to a river. The river is very choppy. He cannot cross it. If he swims across, attempts to swim across it, he's going to die. So he spends months building a raft. Right, building a robust enough raft that will get him across the river. And so he finally does. He builds this really heavy, robust raft, gets across the river, gets to the other side. And then the sort of almost parable or the riddle that Buddha puts to his disciples is like, okay, so now he's got this raft, but he knows the rest of his destination is on foot. So what does he do? Does he leave the raft or does he pick this raft up and carry it on his head? And the disciples are all like, well, of course he leaves the raft behind. He doesn't need it anymore. And the Buddha's whole point is, yeah, but the way we live our lives is we all have a lot of us have this raft that we've sort of built. And now we feel like we need to carry it with us. And that raft doesn't necessarily need to represent bad things. It can, I mean, abusive relationships, you know, past situations where we felt really hurt and we just have a really tough time letting go. But oftentimes that raft can represent good things. It can represent a law degree. It can represent, you know, a success that we feel like now we have to build on top of that, or that in some ways that linearly needs to connect to whatever we do next. But in a lot of ways, what it's doing is just shackling us down.
I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com.
Doing creative work can be kind of lonely, and that's why we built the Unmistakable Listener Tribe. The Tribe is a community for professionals to connect and support each other. Everything is designed to help you grow your business and share what's working and what isn't. And that's true whether you're a business owner or an artist. You'll get access to feedback, live conversations with guests, and so much more. By joining the Tribe, you become part of a community of creators who all support each other, and it's completely free. Hopefully I'll see you there. Visit unmistakablecreative.com/tribe to join. Again, that's unmistakablecreative.com/tribe. Sunil, welcome to the Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Srini, it's great to be here. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, it is my pleasure to have you here. So I actually contacted you because I came across your book, Backable, The Surprising Truth Behind What Makes People Take a Chance on You. And I remember very distinctly seeing it on Amazon when it was ready for pre-order. And I was like, when the hell is this thing going to be available? And then I saw Neil Strauss put out a tweet about it and I bought it right away. And I think I tore through it in like maybe less than two days. And I emailed you right away and said, you know, you have to come talk to our audience. This is about more than venture capital. Like, creatives need to hear this. Yeah. But before we get into all of that, I want to start by asking what I think is a very relevant question. That is, what did your parents do for work and how did that end up shaping and influencing the choices that you have made throughout your life and your career?
Yeah. So both my parents are engineers. They both worked at Ford Motor Company for over 35 years. My mom is really, in a lot of ways, one of the foundational stories of why I decided to write Backable. And I think in a lot of ways, just kind of what's defined, you know, her path is very much defined our career. When I say my brother Sanjay and me, you know, she grew up in a refugee camp right on the border of Pakistan and India, and she had this really unlikely dream, which is that she wanted to be an engineer with Ford. And you know, she had read Henry Ford's biography and said, "That's what I want to go do." That, and you know, people laughed at her, but her parents got, you know, behind the dream. They saved every penny they had and got her on a boat where she came to the United States. She got a scholarship to Oklahoma State University. The day after she graduates, she heads to Detroit, Michigan to apply for her dream job. So she gets in this room with a hiring manager, and this guy looks at her resume and he says, "Wait a second, are you applying for the job of an engineer?" And she says, "Yeah." And he says, "Well, you know, look, we actually don't have any female engineers working here right now." Because it was the 1960s, and Ford Motor Company was in its heyday, doing really well. Thousands upon thousands of engineers on staff, but not a single one of them was a woman. So she's, you know, deflated, feels rejected in this moment. She gets up, she grabs her resume and picks up her purse, and she's about to walk out of the room. And then in this last sort of ditch effort, she turns around and she looks this hiring manager in the eyes and she tells him her story of all the struggle that she had to go through to get to this very room. And then she summons up all the courage she can. And she says, "Look, things are changing. And if you don't have any female engineers on staff, then do yourself a favor and hire me now." And so that's how in 1967, Damayanti Hingorani, now Damayanti Gupta, my mom, becomes Ford Motor Company's first female engineer.
Wow. So what the numerous questions come from just that story alone. Like, what is it that causes a person in a moment like that to turn around the way that your mom did versus the one who just walks out and accepts their fate? Like, what do you think is the difference between those two people?
Yeah. It's a great question. I ask my mom that all the time. You know, I think one thing that, you know, she has probably taught me more than anything else is that, you know, it's not that she wasn't scared in those moments. Or if I talk to her about her full journey, right? Like I somehow, when I was young, I almost had this image of her as somebody who's just courageous by nature. Like that's what it was, courage that led to action. But what I realized over time and talking to her, and now that I'm older and really understanding her at, I think, a deeper level, what I realized is that it was the reverse. Mm-hmm. It was action that led to courage. She was just taking these moves. She was just taking these steps, and then just kind of letting courage sort of follow up. So there were all these moments that she was in her dorm room afraid because, you know, she hadn't seen her family in years or communicated with them in any way, shape, or form. That, you know, they didn't have a phone back in their village. So it was just literally just letters, many of which would never arrive. And, you know, those were frightening moments. And so I just think that there's this sense of take action first, let the rest catch up later, which, to be honest with you, I'm still trying to do. Like, I don't feel like I've ever been in a situation where I have felt like I absolutely needed to do that in the way that she felt like she needed to do this. So for that reason, maybe, you know, the actions that I've taken, I've had the luxury of letting courage catch up a little bit before I actually take action. Whereas I think in her case, she didn't have that luxury.
Yeah. Well, I mean, so the other thing that I think is really interesting, and I think this is common, you know, with Indian immigrants, and I see this in my own parents' stories, is there's a level of resourcefulness that they seem to just have, you know, innate to them. Yeah. And Scott Belsky talks about this, you know, in a couple of his books, where he talks about this sort of distinction between having resources versus resourcefulness. And I remember very distinctly Jessica Livingston in the the interview book that she did, is she said that one of the things she notices the moment founders raise money, they actually become less resourceful because they have an abundance of resources. So I wonder, you know, that sort of resourcefulness, how is that something that you develop in yourself? Like, how do people develop that within themselves? Because I think that that's such an invaluable thing, because that's infinite, whereas your resources, no matter how much you have, are finite.
Yeah. I mean, I think what you're saying is super interesting to me, because, you know, I noticed, you know, when I was working in Silicon Valley, you and I were both talking about our time, you know, out in the Bay Area. And, you know, when I was raising money for my first company, Rise, I mean, I was getting rejected by every investor that I pitched. I was zero for over a dozen. And, you know, there was a whole journey that took place where the company ended up moderately successful. But what I was fascinated by was, after I had sold the company, a lot of the same investors who had rejected me were now saying, "Hey, what are you doing next? You know, and here's a check." And there was one investor who said, "Look, why don't we just what do you want to do next?" And I said, I don't know, I'm not sure." And the VC literally said, "Well, why don't we just form like a new co, like a holding company right now? We'll fund it right now off the bat, and then you can change it to whatever you want to." And I thought to myself, like, so what is, you're basically saying you're going to fund a non-idea, like a non-idea. And I thought to myself, based on what? Like, it's not that I necessarily have like a bulletproof track record in any way, shape or form. What I realized, I did camp out inside a couple of VCs. And what I started to realize is that, you know, not only was that probably not the right sort of thing for them to offer me, which I never ended up taking, but like what I often saw, and I'd be interested to hear if you see this as well, is like second time founders or repeat founders who have had some sort of success behind them often underperform. They underperform compared to first time founders. They certainly underperform compared to second time founders that are coming off of a failure. And I think a lot of it comes back to that resourcefulness that you're talking about, or resources versus resourcefulness. People who don't have the track record, people who don't have a win underneath their belt, have to be resourceful versus, you know, the others that already have the resources, and maybe just kills the hunger.
Yeah, no, I definitely see that, because I remember my roommate who was the fifth employee at Yelp. He was telling me he went to work at a couple of other startups, and there was a guy who came from another really well-known company that I won't mention by name. But he said, you know, the guy basically thought because the first startup was such a success that he had sort of a Midas touch, and the next one was just a complete flop.
Yeah, happens all the time, right?
Yeah. So I guess then, how do you actually prevent ego from getting in the way and resting on your laurels when you've already had a success? Because I think this is something that I see with writers too, right? So you look at sort of Ryan Holiday is a great example of somebody who really maintains, you know, does a good job doing this, because he said to me once that, you know, what an editor once told him was that success gives you the conditional opportunity to try again. And that always stayed with me. And now here we are 8-9 books later with Ryan, and he's always working on the next book. Like, he's never resting on his laurels. So how do you prevent that from happening when you've had a success? Because people tend to get confident, which is great, but they can also get overconfident.
Yeah. I guess there's a difference between, you know, being confident in your process versus being confident in the outcome, right? Like what I now have, I'm working on my second book now, and what I am confident about is, like, I think I know how to write, and I think I'm familiar with how to write a book. You know, sure. I know how to sit down in the mornings. I know how to do deep work in a way that I didn't before. I know how to keep banging my head against the desk, even though, you know, nothing's coming out really, like of use. I know the importance of throwaway work, right? I remember having a conversation with Salman Rushdie when I was in law school. He was passing through town. He's one of my favorite authors. And I asked him, what inspires you to write? How do you get inspired every day to write? and it was like the worst. It was like the worst possible question that I could have asked him, because I mean, it showed to him immediately, like, this is clearly not a writer or anybody who's tried to, like, going through the writing process, because he's like, you know, I don't get inspired to write. I sit down at my desk every day, just like anybody who's, you know, committed to their work. And I just write. I write. He's like, I almost had, like, the, you know, in terms of hours, I almost seem like an accountant more than anything else. Like, sit down at 9, I write for about 8 hours until 5 o'clock. And he's like, the vast majority of what I write is unusable. It goes in the trash bin. But like every day, there's like a pearl, right? There's a pearl. Yeah. There's something that's usable. And what I do for a living is I take these little pearls and I string them together into paragraphs and eventually chapters and eventually books. That's what I do for a living.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
As creators, we're always on the move. Whether it's a live podcast event, a pop-up shop, or a workshop, we're constantly interacting with community, and that's where Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe comes in. Imagine this. You're at a live event, a listener loves your merch, or a participant wants to sign up for your course on the spot. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, you can accept their payments right there and then, right from your iPhone, so there's no extra hardware or no delays. Total game changer. It's not just for creators. Any business owner can do this. It's about making transactions smoother and much more personal, growing your business in your way. We've been using Stripe for our products and courses for a long time, and now with Tap to Pay on iPhone, you can take your business to the next level too. So visit stripe.com/tapiphone to learn more. Remember, folks, with Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, your business is always at your fingertips.
Yeah, I mean, the reason I laugh is because I write 1,000 words a day religiously. Like, it's just something I've done for the better part of the last 8 or 9 years. I've written 2 books. And to your point, like, you learn how to write a book. You don't necessarily learn how to write a bestseller. But the reason I'm laughing is because I remember meeting some girl at a party once, and she's, you know, tells me she'd been working on a book for 5 years. And she looks at me and says, well, you can't just sit down and write. And one of my friends who worked with me said, dude, you're the wrong person to say that to. And I literally looked at her. I was like, yeah, that is the biggest bunch of bullshit I've ever heard, which is not a polite thing to say to somebody you've just met. So needless to say, I didn't rub her the right way, but it was fascinating that, you know, we looked at that. But let's actually go back.
I'm curious about that real quick, though. So you sit down, you said you write 1,000 words every day.
Yeah.
And does that take you just different amounts of time?
It varies. I mean, there are days, well, it depends on, you know, whether I can get into a flow, like if I'm doing deep work, if I'm not distracted. Yeah. Some days I can do it in 30 minutes and I'll produce golden 30 minutes. Other days I'll do it for an hour and a half and have nothing but garbage. Like the way I describe it is you're shoveling a mountain of shit for an ounce of gold.
Yeah. That's totally true. But I am fascinated though, because I have heard people saying like 3 hours no matter what, or 2 hours no matter what. But I like the idea of like 1,000 words no matter what. Because it does, well, I think, hold more accountable.
Well, Julian Smith was the one who turned me on to that idea. And Julian Smith had one of the most popular blogs on the internet when he told me about that. And I thought, okay, you know what? He's written 2 bestsellers and he has one of the most popular blogs on the internet. I will do that. And within 6 months of starting that, I ended up self-publishing a Wall Street Journal bestseller. So when you get a result like that from a behavior, you kind of are like, okay, I'm never going to stop doing this.
Yeah. Are there ever times just to fulfill the quota that you're just like, just continuously running the screen?
It doesn't get that bad, but a lot of it is just incoherent psychobabble.
Yeah.
It's exactly the way Rushdie described it to you, right? So you might write 800 words and one sentence might end up being the title of a blog post. And the next day you build on that and you suddenly have a lot more.
Yeah. No, see, now that's a good question too. Like do you leave yourself prompts to just get going?
So I don't read myself prompts, but what I do is I read for anywhere between 45 minutes to an hour before. So right. For example, if I'm reading your book, I'll take a quote from the book and that quote will be my prompt. And this is psychology for anybody who wants to know. I learned this from Sean Acor's book, The Happiness Advantage of All Places. So there's a concept called success accelerants, and where he talks about the fact that your brain makes progress towards a goal based on the perceived distance to that goal. And what happens when you use somebody else's quote is it shortens that perceived distance, so you're able to get some momentum going. And if you're reading, you're kind of making connections in your head and connecting dots and all of that.
That's totally right. Are there books that you kind of go to as are you always reading new stuff, or is there a book or two you kind of go to for
It's a mix, but there's definitely a few that I keep on the shelf like at all times, and I'm looking at it right now. Pretty much anything by 50 Cent and Robert Greene, Ryan Holiday books, anything by Seth Godin, Cal Newport stuff, and then a few sort of life philosophy books. I don't even remember them. I read The Wealth of Nations recently, Stephen Pressfield. It's just kind of, I think really what it is it's kind of what I always describe. I always say like trying to write without reading is like trying to cook without any ingredients.
Yeah. No, it's so true. By the way, Pressfield, I've always admired his work. Like I love the War on Art, or War of Art. But what I didn't realize is how connected the Legend of Bagger Vance was to the Bhagavad Gita.
Yeah, I remember that.
I remember watching the movie and just, honestly, not liking it all that much. And then someone told me that like the book is so much better and also just deeply connected to the Gita. And I'm like, no way. And I went and read it recently, and it was like, it blew my mind. Have you read it?
What? Not the Legend of Bagger Vance, but I actually did read the Gita, and I read a bunch of books related to it.
Yeah,
it turns out the Lion King is also based loosely on the Bhagavad Gita, like some of the themes.
I did not know that.
Fun facts. Well, let's get back to your growing up, because this is something I always have to ask people who are raised by immigrants, particularly Indian immigrants, because we have had a similar upbringing. What was the narrative about careers around your house? I mean, you became a lawyer, obviously. So was it, hey, doctor, lawyer, engineer, or did you actually get advice to go and do something different?
I think it definitely was around lawyer, doctor, engineer, for sure. But there was always sort of a sense of, I guess in my house, there was always, because of my mom's story, a sense of like, it could be that and something else. Like it could be like, go make your mark somehow. Right. And don't feel like you need to follow the norm. My older brother is 10 and a half years older than me. And so, Sanjay was a practicing physician in suburban Michigan when I was going to college, and he was very good. He's a surgeon. He got a great program and got a great role. And he was inherently, I think, just unhappy. I mean, unhappy with the idea of like, this is going to be it. This is what I'm going to be doing. And he was very interested in the idea of like healthcare and news. And he was interested in the idea that you could tell stories in a way that was just, much broader than what he was doing every day inside like the waiting rooms. And so, I still remember one day he comes back to the house and we were all having breakfast, and he's like, I wanna go see if I can apply for a job at CNN, right? Zero on air experience, zero journalism experience, but he's like, this is something I would like to do. And I remember thinking to myself, like, oh, how are my parents really going to react to this? And I think my dad was a little less like, he was a little more uneasy about the whole thing, but my mom was like, go do it. Go give it a shot. And not only that, like, it was like, I'm now going to hold you accountable for giving that a shot. You just shared something with me, and now like you're like, I'm going to be on you about this. And so he does. And he becomes CNN's, first chief medical correspondent, Dr. Sanjay Gupta. I think that kind of mentality, was sort of, I think welcomed in our house more so maybe than I think some of my friends who grew up in, immigrant households, which is like, stay the lane, stay the path.
Totally. Well, so I guess on that note, you know, a lot of parents are listening to this. Based on how your parents raised you, what would you tell parents who are listening to this about their own children? I mean, you're a father too, you mentioned. So like, you know, how's that impacted the way you're raising your kids?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I play a little game with my daughters every morning. We've been doing this really ever since the pandemic began, and they're both like, you know, started homeschool. And so I asked them, and one's 8 and one's 4. And I asked them, what is the meaning of life? And they say to me, to find your gift. And I say, well, what is the purpose of life? And they say, to give it away. And it's all based on a quote from Picasso, one of my favorite quotes, but I love playing this little back and forth with them. You know, my father had emergency triple bypass surgery when he was not much older than me. And, you know, it was like caught it in the nick of time. And had we not, like, I just don't know I don't think he would be here with us right now. And so I think about that because like, what do you, especially now, like, you know, you can't take anything for granted. What do you want to leave them with? For me, like the answers to those two questions is a very important thing for me to leave them with. I think when it comes to giving our gift away, both finding our gift and giving it away, I think that the advice that I try to give myself and try to stay true to is like, it's very tempting to want to give them a map, right? Mm-hmm. It's very, very tempting to want to say, if you do this, then you will get this. From there, you go there. Here are the steps, and here's what the first step looks like, and here's what the last step looks like. And instead, I've tried to, you know, do what our good common friend Jace Jarvis says, was to trade that map in for a compass, right? Yeah. To give them a compass by which they can decide not what the last step is, but what the next right thing is. And I think that's very much a function of not just examining the way the world is, but being able to like tune into yourself and figure out what it is you want. And also a function of realizing that your last step may influence your next step. It may inform your next step, but it doesn't have to determine your next step.
I love that. Yeah. I mean, we have this guy, Stephen Shapiro here, who wrote a book called Goal Free Living, which literally flies in the face of everything I'd ever heard in personal development. And he said something that just stayed with me. And he said, you want to choose a direction rather than a destination. And yeah. I thought about that. I was like, wow, that actually opens up so many more possibilities for where you could end up. Because I remember, you know, at Berkeley, it was very clear. Like it was just sort of, hey, here are your majors. Here are the potential career paths that each major leads to. And I was like, wow, in the span of 4 years, we've narrowed down the possibilities for our life into doctor, lawyer, engineer, or management consultant.
Yes. And you know, and I think that it's, to a certain degree, it's fine because you have to choose something at that age. I think that like we are sort of in a position where we're asked to choose something. I think the tricky thing becomes, or at least where I've seen the real pain set in, is when you then get 5 to 10 years down the line and you feel like what you've done in the past, you know, predetermines what you have to do in the future. I mean, I'm, mm-hmm. you know, I'm about 10 years out of law school now. I went to my 10th year reunion and I met, you know, some former classmates who seemed perfectly happy with what they were doing. But I also met some who seemed perfectly miserable with what they were doing. And, and there was a good friend of mine who, you know, we went and grabbed drinks afterwards and I was talking to him and he's like, man, I'm not happy. And I'm like, well, why don't you go do something else? And it was one of these uncomfortable conversations where he's like, you know, I could just tell that he felt very anchored, almost shackled by the decision that he made when he was 23 years old to go get a law degree, right? And yeah. Now that decision is driving and influencing, it's not just influencing, but it's shackling what he's doing now, you know, in his 30s. And so I, you know, the Buddha told this great story to his disciples about a guy who is, you know, comes to a river. The river is very choppy. He cannot cross it. If he swims across, attempts to swim across it, he's going to die. So he spends months building a raft, right? Building a robust enough raft that will get him across the river. And so he finally does. He builds this really heavy, robust raft, gets across the river, gets to the other side. And then the sort of almost parable or the riddle that Buddha puts to his disciples is like, okay, so now he's got this raft, but he knows the rest of his destination is on foot. So what does he do? Does he leave the raft or does he pick this raft up and carry it on his head? And the disciples are all like, well, of course he leaves the raft behind. He doesn't need it anymore. And the Buddha's whole point is, yeah, but the way we live our lives is we all have a lot of us have this raft that we've sort of built, and now we feel like we need to carry it with us. And that raft doesn't necessarily need to represent bad things. It can, I mean, abusive relationships, you know, past situations where we felt really hurt and we just have a really tough time letting go. But oftentimes that raft can represent good things. It can represent a law degree. It can represent, you know, a success that we feel like now we have to build on top of that, or that in some ways that linearly needs to connect to whatever we do next. But in a lot of ways, what it's doing is just shackling us down.
Yeah. So I want to start talking about the book, but I have one other question. And this is about you and your brother. So 10-year age gap, older brother. I'm the older sibling. And I feel like in any immigrant family, the older sibling is the experiment. The second one is the one where parents fix everything they fucked up on the first one. And the younger one gets away with murder in comparison. So what I wonder is, was there any contrast in terms of the type of advice your parents gave each of you about making your way in the world? Because like you're talking about 10 years later, your parents have had the experience of raising one kid. So they've dealt with all this stupid bullshit like teenagers do, like, hey, I need expensive shoes and nice clothes to fit in at school.
Yeah.
So I wonder, like, what was the contrast like in terms of you know, your experiences when you were younger?
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, I think I certainly had it much easier, than my brother. I think that, like, you know, my parents were both, you know, I think it, you know, the immigrant story is an experiment, right? It's like, is this thing going to work? You know, is this thing that we sort of set out to do, probably against the wishes of a lot of people who are sort of in our circles back home, is it going to work? And I think that there was a tremendous amount of pressure on Sanjay to sort of make the answer to that be yes. And by the time that I came along, you know, by the time that, like, you know, I was in, I don't know, third, fourth grade, where my parents were actually starting to pay attention to how I'm doing in school, like, Sanjay was already, like, doing very, very well. Like, he was, you know, he ended up being valedictorian at school. So I think to a certain degree, it sort of took the pressure off of me. And, you know, I was definitely not as high a performer, you know, academically as Sanjay. And I think that always sort of, like, you know, that always irked my parents. But I think there was also sort of, there was always sort of the sense of, like, well, at least Sanjay's doing well, right? So, yeah. You know, I think Sanjay being 10 years older than me, he is like a third parent. So I always sort of had that, you know, where I had somebody who grew up here, who grew up in my situation, who I could turn to for advice, whereas he didn't really have that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, it's funny because my sister got, like, astronomically better grades than I did at Berkeley. And I was like, yeah, that's because I taught her how to pad her GPA the first semester. And, like, because I screwed that up royally. But yeah, no, I mean, I remember very distinctly in high school, I had a friend whose mother told him, if you want me to go to my grave in peace, you'll become a doctor. And when I told my mom that, she was actually thrilled about it. And she more or less, she'll deny this to the day she dies. But she told me once, if you don't become a doctor, I won't pay for you to go to college. Mm. My dad was like, look, you're going to get there and you do whatever the hell you want. Just tell her you'll become a doctor for now. And so, but, you know, I joked that my sister at least satisfied our family quota for becoming a doctor. We need at least, you know, every Indian family needs one.
Totally. Totally.
No. Well, so what has been the trajectory that led you from law school to startups to writing Backable?
Yeah, when I was finishing up law school, I met my, you know, now wife. We were dating, and the plan was pretty laid out for us. We were going to go, you know, I was at Northwestern, so was she. She was at the journalism program, and we both had offers at, you know, for places in New York. She was going to go work at a you know, on air, and I was going to go work at a big corporate law firm. And at the last sort of, you know, couple months before graduation, I basically had a panic attack about the whole plan. I said, you know, something's off here. I don't feel like I'm going to be happy practicing law. Like, I have that feeling in my gut, and, or at least not going to, like, a big corporate law firm. And so I started to, I started to make trips out to Silicon Valley. And I should say, at this point in time, this is in 2008, and I was working on the Obama campaign. And, you know, I'd worked in politics. You know, one of my first jobs out of college 4 years before was working for the Democratic National Committee. And I was backstage in 2004 when Barack Obama gave his big speech, his first big speech. And I saw, while it seemed like the world was watching him, I was watching the world because I got this sort of backstage view, and I watched this like tidal wave of energy rip through the crowd. And I thought to myself, I want to go be on whatever that guy is doing next. I want to be a part of it. And that was in large part why I ended up in Chicago. And so I kind of used this idea that I was working in politics to connect with other people who were excited about this intersection of tech and politics. And one of those people was Reid Hoffman. And I through a few introductions, finally got my way into a meeting with him where I said to him, look, I don't want to go practice law. He's like, I don't blame you. and I said, I'd love to come out here and I'd do whatever. I'll, you know, sweep floors if I need to. At that time, he was working at Mozilla. I mean, he'd founded LinkedIn, but he was a chairman of Mozilla. And mm-hmm. He's like, you know, I think based on sort of your political interests and your interest in tech, this might be a really cool place for you. And so I started to, you know, I went and visited Mozilla. And what I found was like a group of just activist programmers, like people with this just almost renegade sort of attitude about like, hey, we can change the world, even though we're completely understaffed over here, even though we're a nonprofit, we can go head to head with companies like Microsoft. And I love that. It was intoxicating to me. And so I begged them for a job, and I ended up landing something. And it was sort of on the legal. It was skewed towards the legal side of the company. And at that point, we had one lawyer in house, and the idea was I would help him out. But I found myself just spending all my time on the other side of the small building, which was with the designers and engineers, like asking what they were up to and asking questions. And eventually, that sort of led to me helping out with a feature that we shipped. And someone said, hey, you know, maybe product management is your thing. And so I took on another feature and I shipped that. And eventually I just became a product manager inside. And that's how I cut my teeth.
Wow. So I love the fact that you took this sort of lateral move. So a couple of questions come through. One, what parts of your legal background were you able to apply to being a product manager? Because I think people often tend to write off their skills. Because I saw this with a woman in one of our coaching programs, and she told me, she was like the marketing director for the American Marketing Association. I was like, wait a minute, you probably know more about marketing than all of us here, and we're teaching you. You should be teaching a workshop to us on this. But I think people often discount skills from their past because they think they're useless.
Yeah.
And so one, you know, how do people take inventory of, you know, tangible skills that are relevant to what they're doing, even though they might not realize? Because it seems like that's exactly what you did.
Yeah. You know, it's a really good question. And I certainly do. And I certainly apply things that I learned in the past, even though they weren't required. They weren't sort of like, you know, to be a product manager at Mozilla, there was nowhere in the job description that you need to have a law degree. But, you know, one thing that I learned in law school, I still remember, I wrote a paper and it was my first year, and I handed it into my professor, and I got like, it was returned to me in like ton of red ink. You know, it was basically like, I failed the assignment. And I thought I'd argued sort of for my client, which was the assignment. I thought I'd argued for my client very, very well. So I'm like, what is going on? Like, what's the meaning of all this? And I went and asked her, and she's like, yeah, but you did not argue the other side. You did not point out what the other side was likely going to say and what your answers to that were. This is basically 50% complete. You've only talked about like why you're right. But you haven't talked about the arguments that other people are going to sort of pull out. And that was a very, very important lesson for me, because it ultimately ended up being something that was really important for the book as well. In the book, we talk about this idea of steering into the objections of your own idea. And it was in law school that I really learned that, which is like, you know, you can get really, really excited about your own point of view. And this is especially true for product management. You get excited about a feature, you get excited about an idea, you get excited about something that's creative. But to be able to take that hat off and put on the critic hat and then think through, all right, objectively here, what are the top three reasons why people are going to think this is wrong? What are the top three reasons people are going to think this is something worth investing in? And then answering those is how you actually get ready for a room. You know, it could be how you get ready for a courtroom, but it could also be how you get ready to rally your team, you know, around an idea on a Zoom conversation. Is you can proactively yourself steer directly into those objections, and then talk about what the answers to those objections are.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST. Code ACAST.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Yeah. Well, let's get into the concepts in the book. And I think I emailed you and I told you right at the beginning, you know, why I liked the book so much was because I felt like it was so relevant to my own story. I went from being the guy who got fired from every job to being a guy who raised a round of venture funding.
Yeah.
And on my first attempt, which was, you know, a stroke of luck if there ever was one. But, you know, so one of the things you say as you at the opening of the book is that people who change the world around them aren't just brilliant, they're backable. They have a seemingly mysterious superpower that lies at the intersection of creativity and persuasion. When backable people express themselves, we feel moved. When they share an idea, we take action. What moves people isn't charisma, but conviction. Backable people earnestly believe in what they're saying, and they simply let the belief shine through, whatever style feels most natural. And what that reminded me of was something that Chris Sacca said to Tim Ferriss on the Tim Ferriss podcast. You might remember this. He says this in every speech that he ever gives. And he said that when he invests in a founder, the one thing they all have in common is that they believe that their success is inevitable.
Mm.
And so I wonder, you know, and I felt there was a lot of overlap between what you said and you know, what you said there. And I've asked a handful of people this. Do you think that that is something that is inherent or something that people can develop, that belief that their success is inevitable?
I think that it's something that can be developed, for sure. There's no doubt that certain people just sort of come up with ideas and sort of have this feeling of inevitability. And, you know, and I think that like that doesn't always end well. right? And I would argue that some of it ends badly. I mean, we're thinking about sort of, you know, the Fire Festival. We're thinking about certain situations like WeWork, right? Theranos. Yeah. Like, I think that there, you know, Elizabeth Holmes talks a lot about conviction, you know, and yeah, you know, but what's that conviction really based on? I think for those of us that don't have the ability to come up with an idea and have this almost ability to look others in the eyes and say, I 100% believe in that. I think the vast majority of us can't do that. The vast majority of people who are high integrity can't do that. And so you develop that conviction. And I think you do that in different ways. We talk about a bunch of different ways in the book. I personally like to write my ideas out. I like to, you know, one of the things we found is that when you look at sort of the way that ideas are shared, even inside big companies, and why great ideas get killed inside companies, what we found is that, like, a lot of those ideas don't get killed inside formal conversations. They don't get killed inside conference rooms. You know, they typically get killed inside very casual conversations in the hallways, in parking lots, when we tend to sort of blurt out the idea before we're actually ready. We blurt it out before we actually have conviction. And then what ends up happening is we sort of look around and we don't get the reaction that we're necessarily looking for. And so we kind of dismiss it immediately. We put it in a mental drawer and we sort of walk away. It happens all the time because new ideas are fragile, and we tend to be pretty fragile when we have new ideas. So what backable people tend to do is they almost catch themselves in that moment, and they do a little decision tree. I'm like, is this an idea that I have high conviction for or not? Like, one way to think about it is, like, is this a peanut M&M or is this a chocolate M&M? Like, a peanut M&M, you can squeeze on it and it's not a piece of metal, but it's not going to crack immediately. Whereas a chocolate M&M, you squeeze it just a little bit and it cracks. If it's a chocolate M&M, then don't share it in that moment, right? Like, Jerry Seinfeld has this saying. I think he actually brought it up on the Tim Ferriss show recently, which is like, don't share that day's material, no matter what, right? No matter what, do not share what you wrote that day with anybody, because it's still very fragile. Backable people tend to sort of take this incubation time to put the peanut inside. And again, getting back to, like, how I personally like to just write out my ideas. I like to, like, start freeform writing, and I try to follow a couple of ground rules that I've learned from you know, backable people. I'm like, what to do when I'm writing this out. One is that you want to be able to wander. You want to let yourself wander. You know, one way to think about it is, like, when you're starting to come up with, like, a new idea, you want to fall in love with the problem, but you don't necessarily want to fall in love with the solution. Let yourself wander in different areas. And I think we get in trouble sometimes where we're like, here's the problem and I know exactly the answer, and I'm just going to write that out. I'm going to start getting into almost like spec mode, where it's like, now I'm starting to, like, really get into the definition of the solution. What backable people tend to do is they tend to sort of allow themselves to meander and wander, knowing that in the vast majority of cases, they're going to end up in somewhere that's better than where they started. That's one thing. The second is that, like, give yourself some sort of end date to that wandering, right? Like, give yourself some sort of timeline, because we all know people who just, like, been hanging on to ideas for years, and it's very easy to do. So one of the things I like to do is I like to just call a friend and say, hey, you know, 3 weeks from now, I want to share an idea with you. And typically the friend will be like, well, yeah, what's this all about? And I'll say, you know, I can't share that with you right now, but like 3 weeks from now, I will, I promise. And what that gives me is something on my schedule now that I know I just don't have an infinite amount of time. There's somebody I need to share it with. It's low stakes, but at the same time, it's there. But now I have enough time where I can actually start to wander a little bit and get to a place that I feel like is shareable.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let's talk about the actual pitch process, because I think this is one of those things that really struck me. And I realized this was, like, identical to my entire experience of pitching, you know, the investors at PodFund. You actually talk about your first, well, first off, tell me about your first experience pitching a venture capitalist.
Yeah. I mean, well, it wasn't positive. I mean, I got in, you know, I'm trying to remember exactly what that first meeting was, but I can tell you the first set of meetings were just, I mean, they were just awful. I mean, I still remember that, you know, at best the meetings were, well, thank you, you know, thanks for coming in. It was almost like polite nodding, And a few sort of questions that I feel like were almost kind of just like very surface level. But there was one thing I got pretty good at even before I started pitching was actually just gauging whether there was excitement in the room. Like I and that's something that I naturally know how to do. I think it comes from my days working in politics. Are people getting excited or not? And I could just tell very much that people were not getting excited. And then I would get the follow-up email. Thanks for coming in. And this is not for us. And that happened over a dozen times in a row.
Well, so with that in mind, one of the things that you say is, I spent almost all of my time working to convince investors and very little time working to convince myself. Yeah. Reverse that, spend 80% of your time convincing yourself, then the remainder pulling together slides, business plans, or whatever else you need to convince a backer. So when you've been rejected a dozen times, how do you keep convincing yourself?
Yeah, I mean, so for me, I had not spent that time really convincing myself. One of the things that I think I see founders do, and I certainly did this as well, is like I jumped straight from idea mode into presentation mode. I literally said, wouldn't it be cool if... So the idea that I had was a one-on-one health coaching service. And, so you get matched up with a private, personal nutritionist right over your mobile phone. And, this is 2012 when I came up with the idea, early 2013 when I started sharing this around with investors. So, pretty early in sort of the telemedicine space. And so there wasn't a lot of precedent for what we were doing, but I was excited about the idea. But I wasn't convinced. Like I hadn't done the work to really build conviction around the idea. I hadn't really taken it out to customers. I hadn't really sort of figured out how this was going to work, the nuts and bolts of it. Yeah, I hadn't done the work to say, I'm ironclad on like why I believe this is going to work. Instead, I kind of shifted from, hey, like I can totally see how this will look on a mobile screen. Let's get some screenshots together. Let's pull together a pretty pitch deck. And so I skipped a step. Which is again, like I skipped straight from idea mode into presentation mode. I would have been much better off spending 80% of that time that I spent in presentation mode, building slides and getting my narrative together. I'd have been much better off spending that 80% really kind of convincing myself, like asking myself the tough questions. Well, why is this? And steering into the objections of like, well, how do you compete with like a Weight Watchers? How do you compete when ad space is so expensive when you talk about weight loss? Things like that, asking questions like that and coming up with answers to those, even if those answers weren't perfect. Then shifting maybe 20% of my time into, creating, some decent looking slides, and then going in and pitching investors.
Yeah, it was funny because I remember when I went into PodFund, I was like, this is what I'm going to do with your money. And the thing is, everything that I said I was going to do, I'd already done because we'd been around for 9 years at that point.
Right.
So it's like, we're going to use your money to produce animated shorts. Here's an example. It was like, we're going to do this. Here's another example. And it was kind of, one of my friends said, he's like, you literally have done everything you said you would do already.
Yeah. So you had extremely high conviction that what you were going to do, the way you were going to use their money was going to work because you already had done it. Right. I mean, and I think that's a high conviction moment for me. I had not, I hadn't built anything. So I needed to complement this with lots of research, with lots of customer discovery, with just getting to the point where I could defend why it was going to work when I don't have evidence that it will.
Yeah. Well, so this actually makes a perfect segue to something else that you mentioned, and I want to spend some time talking about this because I think it's one of those subjects that we kind of brush under the rug or, we wait for a suicide to talk about it. But you say in the startup world, one of the things we obsess about is financial runway, having enough money in the bank to keep making progress in payroll. But what we don't talk about is emotional runway. And Sam Altman talks about this. He says that managing your psychology is, one of the hardest things about being a founder. So let's talk about this idea of an emotional runway, because I think it's more than just about energy and passion. It's also a mental health issue. So for example, when you go and tell your wife, hey, I'm going to go do this thing where I'm not guaranteed an income or I'm not certain. How do you manage that emotionally? Like, because I think it definitely impacts everybody around you.
No, absolutely. I mean, I think you're right. We don't talk about it enough. And I think that, I think it's a huge discussion. I think one of the first things that I learned is to to choose an idea or choose a project where, you know, no matter what the outcome really is, win or lose, you're not going to look back on that time and feel like it was a waste, because what it was to you was something that just really truly lit you up, right? It was something that you felt, you know, so strongly about that, you know, of course the outcome matters, but you weren't doing it for the outcome. Yeah, you know, I remember when I was leaving Groupon, because I was at Groupon for the 3 years before I started my own company, and you know, I joined Groupon before they had raised their Series A. And I left after it was a public company. So I'd seen this just insane sort of growth and ups and downs. But my whole world was focused on e-commerce. And I knew leaving the company that I wanted to go be an entrepreneur, but all of my ideas were focused on e-commerce. I literally like this business school style spreadsheet of ideas. And I remember taking that spreadsheet to a mentor of mine, and she looked at the spreadsheet and then she asked me, okay, which of these ideas actually makes you come alive? And I looked at the spreadsheet and I realized, like, none of them really did. None of them really made me come alive. They made sense, like from an intellectual business point of view. You know, the spreadsheet had, you know, columns like market size and competition. Like I'd done the analysis. And so from an intellectual point of view, yeah, they made sense, but did they really make me come alive? Like, no, they did not. And the story that she shared with me in that moment that has never left me, and I'll share it with you, is, you know, Martin Luther King, when he was deciding whether or not to step into his leadership role, you know, it was a very non-obvious choice for a lot of people, including him, because he was so young. He was like in his 20s. When all this was happening, when he was thinking about like the role that he was going to play. And so he went to go see a mentor of his, Howard Thurman, and he asked him what he should do. And one of the things that Howard Thurman told him was, do not ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive. Because what the world needs is more people who have come alive. And so, and I love that, because I run everything that I do now through that analysis, because there's so many things out there that just make sense, right? They might make money and they might achieve commercial success. But the thing is that, like, when you are running with this idea, it doesn't matter whether you're a founder or somebody trying to steer something internally within a company, or, you know, doing something within your community, you're going to be, whenever you're trying to do anything new, trying to create any type of change, you're going to be on the receiving end of doubt and rejection and failure, and you need to have enough gas in the tank, enough emotional runway to go through that. And you're only going to have that if that idea makes you come alive. Maybe it sounds obvious, I don't know, but like what I find is that we do so much analysis up front about whether this idea is good for the market, and we do very little analysis up front about why this idea is really good for me. Is it good for you?
Wow. I don't think I've ever heard it put that way before. I love that. Well, speaking of, is it good for me? Is it you? I think this is another line that really struck me. This is, you know, when it comes to storytelling, which I think is really relevant to a lot of the people here. You say that I've discovered that founders often tell the story of me, occasionally tell the story of you, and almost never tell the story of us. They tend to miss the opportunity to tell a backer why she's a specific fit for the idea more than any other backer. When we miss this part of the story, we lose the chance to turn an outsider into an insider. So one, how do people make that shift from the story of me to the story of us?
Yeah. Well, you know, the first time the story of us really came up was when I was spending time with the book. You know, I spent time for the book across like all different walks of life, Oscar-winning filmmakers, to celebrity chefs, to founders of iconic companies. You know, one of my favorite interviews was the president of the MacArthur Foundation, which runs the Genius Grant.
And I remember that one.
Yeah, it's just a great, I mean, you know, it's a great, you know, grant to get, because you get like $650,000, no strings attached. No. Like there, you literally could take that six. I mean, when I was talking to you, the foundation, they were like, you could take that $650,000 and you could go buy a house. doesn't matter, right?
No, so that was on my list of things to do is to apply for a MacArthur grant because I know they fund a lot of podcasts. Like they do a lot of stuff at NPR. And I remember looking at that thinking, okay, I have it stored somewhere in my walling as one of those, you know, back burner projects was MacArthur grant.
Now
you reminded me. So I'm going to push it up.
No, I mean, go apply because it just sounds like such a phenomenal sort of thing. And just as a side note, I'm like, buy a house? What do you mean? Like, wouldn't you want them, like, if you're going to give somebody $650,000 because they have an idea, they have a passion, wouldn't you want that money to be sunk into the put in the passion? And they said like, no, you know, if you go buy a house, you know, maybe that takes sort of the mental load off where you can then focus on your passion. We're not going to micromanage how you spend that money. Like go, it's yours, no strings attached. So it's a pretty phenomenal thing. You know, Lin-Manuel Miranda, creator of Hamilton, is a Genius Award recipient. But one of the things that the president of the foundation said to me that I can never forget is that if you are already on a clear path to success, that might actually make you a weaker candidate for the grant. Not a stronger candidate, but a weaker candidate. And I was like, why? And he's like, well, because what we want to do is we want to be able to make a mark on your journey. We want to know that we made a difference. And ultimately, I mean, he was speaking to me from the perspective of the foundation, but isn't that like, as human beings, like if there were like, you know, just a couple of defining qualities of who we are and what we want, everybody, isn't that one of them, which is to know that somehow we made a difference, somehow we made our mark. And you know, if you think about the way that a lot of us sometimes will go into a room, oftentimes we feel like we have to go into a room with an idea that feels bulletproof, right? Where it's like we have every answer. We have everything figured out. We just want you to say yes, or we just want you to write a check. But in doing that, we sort of miss out on this opportunity to tell the story of us, right? The story of me is my idea, my resume, my project, my vision. But the story of us is how my story and your story come together to tell this larger story. So the story of us is, hey, you know, I've got like 90% of this figured out, but there are a few missing ingredients. And as it turns out, you know, you have been doing this podcast, Trini, where you've done, you know, over 1,000 episodes. You know exactly how this is done. And that's exactly the piece that we're missing. And that's why we think we would make a great team. Like having you join us, having you support us, having you be an advisor for us. That's the story. That's the story of us. You know, this is a fundraising thing, but it's really a human thing. I mean, if you pay attention to like the way the neuroscience sort of shakes out, you know, like the IKEA effect, for example, shows us that we value something that we build up to 5 times more than something that we simply buy off the shelf. And so by going in with all the answers, you're making someone into a buyer. You're saying you are buying my thing. But if you go in with not all of the answers, with the opportunity to tell a story of us, you're turning them into a builder. You're saying, let's build things together. And I think you can trace literally every successful project, every successful company, every successful political movement back to conversations where the person with the idea went into a room and treated people like builders and not buyers.
Wow. Wow. Well, let's do this. Let's get into what you call the 4 C's of a backable circle, because I thought that was just invaluable. Like, it's funny because until you put it that way, I didn't recognize that I had all of these people in my life. Yeah. And, you know, I had this woman yesterday who talked about how to change your life by, you know, writing it as a Hollywood screenplay. And she actually walked me through one of her workshops and she literally had me list out allies and antagonists that, and at first I didn't realize why she was doing that. But now I'm looking at this in the context of what you say here and it makes sense. But you talk about the 4 C's and you say, you know, you end up playing, you know, most of your exhibition matches with individuals in the circles. They will wind up. They'll basically be the wind in your backable journey. And while each backable circle is different, there are 4 specific types that are vital. And you mentioned the collaborator, the coach, the cheerleader, and the cheddar. Can you expand on those?
Yeah, definitely. And something that you said really stuck with me too, is like, we didn't realize the importance of our circle. Cause I feel like, as I'm out there talking about the book now, I'm meeting a lot of people who say exactly that. Like I didn't realize how important these relationships really were until all of a sudden I couldn't see them anymore on a regular basis. I just a couple of years ago, I'll tell you this story real quick, and then we'll get into the 4 C's. I took a trip to Bhutan, So this is before the pandemic. And Bhutan measures its progress in a way that no other country does. They look at what they call gross national happiness, which you know, they pay attention to GDP, they pay attention to economic growth, but they consider all that stuff to be a factor that leads up into a much broader, larger, more important metric, which is really the happiness of their people. And they've spent the past 50 years trying to define that and iterate on how to measure that. And some incredible things have happened as a result. Like, for example, it's one of the only countries in the world that's carbon negative. They actually produce more oxygen than they consume. And I remember getting off the plane and feeling like I was breathing for the very first time. The air is so fresh. And they know that contributes very much so to the happiness of their people. And so protecting the environment is a top priority for that reason. But one of the things I just wanted to share with you real quick is when I was there, I had a chance to spend time with the research team, the people who collect all the data. And I asked them, when you're out there having conversations with people, is there one question that you could ask that gives you a pretty good sense of someone's happiness? And they said, yeah, as a matter of fact, there is. And the question is, if you were in trouble right now, who could you call and know with 100% certainty that that person would be there for you? They'd be available for you. And they believe people who have a clear answer to that question have a much higher likelihood of being happy. But there's a twist. And the twist is, whose list are you on? Who could call you and they know with 100% certainty that you would be there for them? And they believe that the answer to that question is just as important, if not more important. So in other words, it's not just a one-way line. It's a circle. It's maybe perhaps what we've always known, which is it all comes back to community and people. And I found that to be very much the case when I was writing the book as well. As I studied the lives of these extraordinary people, what I realized is that they all had these trusted circles of people that even the busiest people were spending time nurturing these relationships because they know how important this small group of people that you can lean on, they can lean on you, really is. And so, yeah, when I was trying to figure out, like, okay, so who are these people? What I realized is that some themes were beginning to emerge and that there were four different types of personalities that backable people tended to have in their circle. And I call these the four C's. So the first is your collaborator. And your collaborator is, you know, you really, when you're with this person, you feel like you're in a Second City jam session with them. Like, they're using words like yes and, they're building on top of your idea. It's very collaborative in spirit. And so that's your collaborator. The second is your coach. And your coach is different than your collaborator because while your collaborator is thinking about whether your idea is good for the market or for the company or for the community, your coach is really the person who knows you intimately well enough to help you understand, is this idea good for you? Like, is this idea something that you're going to want to go run with for the next 3 to 5 years? It gets back to this emotional runway that we talked about. Like, does it fit you? I bring my wife ideas all the time. And she's like, that's a great idea for someone else, right? Like, you're not going to want to run with this thing. This isn't going to be something that you're going to have the juice for in 3 years. You're excited about it right now, but you won't be then. And so your coach is really important. The third is your cheerleader. And your cheerleader is pretty self-explanatory, might sound kind of sappy, but we all need somebody who we can call. And no matter what, they're going to give us that last bit of energy we need before we walk into a room. Well, one of the people that I profiled for the book was Ellen Levy, who Fast Company magazine named the most connected woman in Silicon Valley. So she's got members of Congress in her Rolodex, and she's got Fortune 500 CEOs. But I asked her, like, who do you call right before you walk into a big moment? To a big meeting, a big pitch. And she said, that's easy. I call my mom before those moments. So your cheerleader. And then the fourth, which I think is the least appreciated, but I think probably the most important, is your critic. But I like to call this person your cheddar. And the reason I call this person your cheddar is because if you've ever seen the movie 8 Mile, Eminem is surrounded by a circle of friends throughout the film. And they're all kind of building him up for the most part, but there's one friend named Cheddar who's constantly sort of poking little holes in his ideas. Almost kind of like always pointing out the foil to the plan. And, and what we realize through the film is that it's really Cheddar that gets Eminem ready for the stage. And it's so important because I think we all have a cheddar in our life. This is somebody who has our best interest at heart. We know that. And yet they're not afraid to point out our blind spots. They're not afraid to tell us why something doesn't make sense. And I think the vast majority of us tend to sort of push that cheddar away, right? It's kind of the conversations are kind of annoying. So we don't want to have them. But what I noticed amongst backable people is they tend to embrace their cheddar. They tend to pull that person in because they know that it's cheddar that's really going to get them ready for the room.
Yeah. I mean, I worked with a writing coach to do my first two books with Penguin, and she had edited books for Seth Godin, and her commentary was brutal. It took me a month to stop taking it personally. And finally, I clicked. I was like, this is a reason I chose her, and she's doing the job I hired her to do, which is to get me to write the best damn book that I could write. And so I finally realized, like, I had to learn how to separate criticism, you know, on the work. And this, I think, is a real challenge for creative people. This is why I stopped coaching writers who wanted to write books, because I learned how to, give feedback from this woman who gave brutal feedback. And so that was my way of doing it. It's like, I don't have time to deal with your emotional bullshit. I will tell you what's wrong with this.
Yeah.
And Ryan Holiday has a really great quote in Perennial Seller about this, where he says, you know, harsh and critical feedback is something you have to learn to take. And sometimes it comes from the people who care the most about you.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. And I think that's a defining characteristic of cheddar as well. I mean, you taking harsh and critical feedback from someone who you don't know has your best interest at heart is probably going to fall flat, you know, for the most part. Right. But if you know, like, hey, this person's coming from a good place, right? Like, I think that's gold.
Yeah, absolutely. I think I'm that person to my roommate. I was going through the Enneagram book and they're like, oh, you're personality type 6. And apparently personality type 6s tend to be cheddar.
Wow. So, check that out.
So there's something you say about, you know, the two types. You say there are two types of people in the world. There are those who play the game of someday and those who play the game of now. Mm. Every backable person I've met at some point in their career learns to play the game of now. And I want to tackle this question from a different perspective than maybe somebody has asked you before. So you and I come from relatively privileged circumstances.
Yeah.
You know, I'm the son of a college professor, you're the, you know, son of engineers. And I think a message like that is really easy for people like us to embrace because of the circumstances and the context in which we're able to look at that message. But if somebody is barely surviving, in how do you account for that when they hear that message? Because I think we tend to do that to people and say blanket, you know, across the board, this is universally true. And I know that this is something you think about, given that you've spent time, you know, running for Congress. So I know for a fact this has to be on your mind.
Yeah. It is not a universal message for sure. Meaning that people who there are some people. There are many people rather out there who, and a lot of them live in my neighborhood where I am right now, where it's like, they don't have the luxury of necessarily dropping out, moving to Paris and becoming a painter or anything in between here and there. Right. Like it's they're living month to month. And right now it is the way it is. Right. And I don't think a message of, hey, like, leave what you're doing right now, go take that risk, is necessarily something that will resonate, and nor should it. I think though that there are many, many people out there who are not in those situations, who are afraid of taking that risk. And I think that what we have to do is unpack what that risk really is. And it gets to what you just talked about, which is like, what really is at stake here? Like, what's truly at stake? For our parents, for your parents, Srini, for my parents, had they failed, what's best case scenario? They have to go back to India. Like, worst case scenario, maybe they're homeless, right? I don't know, but like it's there wasn't a lot of infrastructure around them at that point in time. I get a lot of credit that I don't deserve for doing things like starting a company or, you know, attempting to start companies and for running for Congress and, you know, and it's like, wow, that takes a lot of risk. Yeah, but not really though, because I would still have a roof over my head. I'm not going to starve. Worst case scenario, I can move back with my parents. Like they're just like, right. I mean, I'm nowhere near I'm not even close to the risk profile that they were in, right? So what are we really talking about here? I think at the end of the day, what we're talking about is reputational risk, right? We're talking about the idea that we're not going to have an explanation, which ultimately I think that's what a resume is. It's an explanation that impresses people, or that you know that will impress people if I take a safer path, right? And so that's a very, very different type of risk. And those are the people that I think we have to speak to when we think about sort of the game of someday versus the game of now. Look, at the end of the day, I know people, and you do as well, who are perfectly comfortable doing what they're doing right now. And this isn't to judge them in any way. I have friends here in Michigan that work at auto companies. They've been working at auto companies their entire career. They will probably retire from these auto companies, and they are happy. And this message is not for them. It is for the people, however, that are saying to themselves, look, I'm going to do this for 2 to 3 more years, and then I'm going to go jump to this next thing, right? And then you ask them, well, why? What's going to happen over the next 2 to 3 years? I'm not ready yet. I'm not ready, right? Like, those are the 3 sort of famous words. I'm not ready. Yeah. You know, why aren't you ready? And then it's like, you don't get the answer that, you know, you're not going to build any type of capability over the next 3 years. You're not going to have, you know, dramatically more money in the bank. And the thing that I realized is that, like, if there was one common denominator amongst the hundreds of people that I studied for this book that have all done, I think, extraordinary things, is that none of them were really ready. Like, 3 friends from design school were not ready to start Airbnb. A mid-level talent manager who was living paycheck to paycheck wasn't ready to start SoulCycle. Yeah, a 15-year-old from Stockholm, Sweden was not ready to build an environmental movement. But today, Greta Thunberg is Time Magazine's youngest person of the year. Like, these people were not ready. And there were setbacks, and there were failures, and there were mistakes along the way. But I think they all sort of adopted, you know, what I call in the book, the game of now. And the defining characteristic of the game of now is that the opposite of success is not failure, it's boredom.
Wow. Yeah, you know, it reminds me of that 50 Cent quote from his book, Hustle Harder, where he says, don't look at the immediate payoff of something, look at the long-term potential. And, you know, like, I remember sitting around my parents' house for 7 years building Unmistakable, and, you know, it was going nowhere. Like, I could have easily, not maybe easily considering I've been fired from all of them, but I could have gotten a job. And I realized what was happening during that time was, you know, I wrote about this once. I said, you know, there's a difference between your current earnings and your earning potential over time. And where I learned this lesson, believe it or not, was back in Silicon Valley. Mm-hmm. I graduated in 4.5 years. So I had 1 more semester left in school. And I had 2 interviews. One was with some guy who ran an online gift registry, and he told me, we'll pay you $25 an hour. Another was with a young startup founder. And he said, look, I don't have any money, barely any money. He said, but you'll basically be my right-hand person. You'll learn a lot. That guy ended up, if I remember correctly, being Orrin Hoffman, who went on to make hundreds of millions of dollars. Yeah. And I always jokingly say, $15 cost me $100 million.
That's funny. I know Orrin. Yeah. Like, I mean, yeah.
I'm pretty sure it was him. I don't know if exactly it was him, but I very distinctly remember something along those lines. But I never forgot that experience.
Yeah. 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 No, I love that. I love that quote. And you were asked me in the beginning of the interview, like, what do I want for my kids? I think it's that, right? I think it's the ability to say, you know, like, let me look at the long term. And again, like, you know, there's privilege to that for sure. Yeah. For sure. There's privilege to that, because I hope that, you know, you know, my goal is not to get to FU money, but my goal is to be able to get them the ability to say, yeah, I can take some risk, and, you know, go chase a couple of things that maybe I otherwise wouldn't have chased, and go commit to those. That's the goal. And, you know, I would hate for them to feel like they can't take those risks, or they want to take the safer path, even though the other path is one that just makes them come alive.
Yeah. Well, I'm so glad you brought up the FU money term, because I wanted to ask you, you know, you've sold startups now, you've been, you know, you've had this book come out. So by, you know, most measures, you're successful, you know, financially, probably, I'm guessing you're doing pretty well. Has your definition of success and wealth changed as a byproduct of that?
Yeah, in a lot of ways. I think, like, you know, I guess I'm just no longer, you know, I guess at a certain point in time, I started to think to myself, I have enough. You know, there was a feeling of enoughness, and it wasn't a lot, but I'm just, you know, it wasn't a lot. Like, I, you know, like my startup did fine. You know, we, you know, I guess in baseball, sort of, you know, we hit like a double, you know, and it gave me enough cushion to have the luxury to be a writer, and to, you know, start making some money off of, you know, some slow money off of what comes off of writing books, which is not a lot, but that complement to what we have is, you know, going to be enough for us in a place like Michigan. And so then, yeah, the question is, can I get over my FOMO of looking at my former colleagues who are out in Silicon Valley, like just making, like a lot of them making a killing, and if, you know, feeling like I'm being left out. Right. And, mm-hmm. and I guess the way that I guess my mindset has shifted is, no, I think that I have enough. I have enough to be able to kind of just do what it is that I want to be able to do. I have enough to spend my days the way that I want to spend my days. And that in of itself is just the richest reward. And it's, again, it's not to judge, because I think we all have to figure out what our own definition of success is. Coming back to Bhutan, the reason that I revere a country like Bhutan isn't because I think they have it all figured out, but it's because they had the courage to be able to say, well, yeah, I know every other country is defining success in a certain way. Let us define it the way that we want to define it. And I think that we have to do that as individuals, is to say, yeah, there's a lot of people who define success in that way. I need to figure out how I define it. And for me, it's very much at the, you know, as Seth Godin would say, it's very much at the verb level and not the noun level, right? The verb level being, what are we actively doing every day? Like, what's the action that's happening at the day-to-day level, rather than the noun of saying something like, well, I'm a venture capitalist, or I'm the founder of a company that's doing really well. I want to write. Like, I just want to write. That's what I want to do. And that to me is success.
Yeah. I love this idea of enough, because we had a woman named Manisha Thakur here, and who was a financial advisor, had billionaire clients. And she said, like, that's the one thing we're lacking is a definition of enough. And I remember in Ryder Carroll's book, he talks about goals, and he specifically talks about financial goals. And he says, you know, if you don't know why you want $1 million, he says, then it's an empty goal. And I remember thinking about all the things that I needed money for. And when I actually came up with the number, I was like, wow, this is so much lower than I actually thought.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. No, I feel exactly the same way. And I have a family as well, you know, and I want to make sure that they're taken care of. But I think if you really sort of, you know, and I think that, like, you know, for me being on completely the same page as with my, you know, partner about this, and just making sure that she and I completely see eye to eye on what it is that we need and what it is we don't need. It's freeing, man. Like, I, at the end of the day, like, I, you know, I'm in my early 40s now, and it's like the thing that I think about more than anything else is freedom, right? Just freedom to be able to do what you want to be able to do. That matters to me so much more than anything else.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I absolutely love that. So it's funny you mentioned sort of the comparison, because I was literally writing about this morning, about why getting everything you want won't ever make you as happy as you think it will, because your reference groups keep changing.
Yeah.
And I realized there was the only antidote to this hedonic treadmill was just being aware of it. Like, you actually are never going to get over that, is what I realized. I was thinking to myself, because, I mean, you know, this as an author, right? You get a book deal from being a blogger or having an online presence, and your reference group is now published authors. And if you're at an imprint like mine, where everybody is like Seth Godin, Ryan Holiday, you go from being a blogger who got a book deal to being the redheaded stepchild of your publisher.
Yeah. And then it just gets back to, like, why do you want to be a writer, right? Do you want to be a writer? Exactly. Do you want to be a writer because you want to be known as a writer? Or do you want to be a writer because you want to write? You know, like, you're sitting down and you're writing 1,000 words every day. Like, you would not be able to sustain that if at the end of the day, what you were trying to do is create bestsellers, right? Like, one of the reframes that I had over the past couple of years is to turn my to-do list into a to-learn list. Like, what do I really want to learn? Right. And for me, I really wanted to learn how to become a better writer. I think I could spend the rest of my career life really trying to learn how to become a better writer. That's what I think about when I sit down at my desk every day. But if my goal, I can tell you this right now, if my goal was I want to write a best-selling book, I never would have written Backable. I never would have written it because I would have every day sat down and I've been like, this is terrible. I never would have published anything. I never would have shared anything out. But I was like, I want to learn how to be a better writer. That's my goal. And so therefore I have to write and therefore I have to put it out there in order to get the feedback that I need in order to improve.
Absolutely. So I have two final questions for you. There's one question and one story I didn't want to get out of this interview without having you tell our listeners. And it was about how your parents met. That probably was one of my favorite parts of the book.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, so Damayanti Hingorani becomes Ford Motor Company's first female engineer in 1967. And then ironically, she's in her job and she's driving around Ann Arbor, Michigan, and her car breaks down. Okay. And so she knows how to look at an engine. She pops the hood and she's inspecting it herself. And she realizes like she's missing a part, like one of the parts is shot. So she walks to a phone booth in town and she opens, you know, cause they had the phone booths back then. And she opens up the phone book as one of those phone books that's attached by that wire to the phone. Yeah. And she looks up the most common Indian name that she can think of. Guy answers the phone and she asks for that guy. And as it turns out, that guy's not home. But the guy who answers the phone says, like, that's my roommate. He's not home. And that guy was my father, the guy who answered the phone. And so he wasn't home. His roommate was home. And so my father and my mom strike up a conversation. He goes down, he helps her with her car. And as they say, you know, the rest is history.
I love that. Well, I have one final question for you, which is how we finish all of our interviews with the Unmistakable Creative. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
Gosh, that's such a good question. I think we all are more of a fingerprint than we think we are. I think we are all very unique. I think that it takes a lot of self-reflection to understand what that is. I very much subscribe to the idea that we are sort of born with certain gifts. And we have responsibilities to those gifts. We have to figure out what those are, and we have to share those. And when we don't, we feel off, and I think other people feel off around us because we're not sharing who it is that we are. And so I think somebody who is unmistakable is somebody who has done the work to really tune into what those gifts are, and then is actively sharing those gifts with the world, giving them away.
Amazing. Well, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to join us and share your story and your wisdom and your insights with our listeners. Where can people find out more about you, your book, and all the work that you're up to?
Yeah, just go to backable.com. You go to backable.com, you'll see some free stuff over there, some free content, and I'd love to connect with you there.
Awesome. And for everybody listening, we'll wrap the show with that.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Unmistakable Creative Podcast. While you were listening, were there any moments you found fascinating, inspiring, instructive, maybe even heartwarming? Can you think of anyone, a friend or a family member who would appreciate this moment? If so, take a second and share today's episode with that one person, because good ideas and messages are meant to be shared.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Have you ever felt a twinge of worry about AI taking over your job or diluting your creativity? Well, what if you could turn that fear into creative fuel? We've just published an amazing new ebook called The 4 Keys to Success in an AI World, and this is more than just a guide. It's a deep exploration into the human skills that AI can't touch, the skills that are essential for standing out and thriving no matter how much technology evolves. We're talking about real differentiators here like creativity, emotional intelligence, critical thinking, and much more. Inside, you'll find actionable insights and strategies to develop these skills, whether you're a creative person, a business person, or just simply someone who loves personal development. This isn't a story about tech taking over. It's a story of human creativity thriving alongside AI. Picture this: AI as your creative co-pilot, not just as a tool, but a collaborator that enhances your unique human skills. The 4 Keys ebook will show you exactly how to do that and view AI in a new way that empowers you instead of overshadows you. Transform your creative potential today. Head over to unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. Use the number 4, K-E-Y-S. That's unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. And download your free copy.